This COE is based on the appellate decisions released in September 2019 that addressed issues related to negligence. The summaries were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in September 2019, and they have since been collected into an update pamphlet, the September 2019 Negligence Update Pamphlet. And it is that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is Flores on page 5. It's a bicycle vehicle accident case, and it brings up how comparative negligence can come into play in a summary judgment motion. The second department held, because plaintiff in this bicycle vehicle traffic accident case affirmatively argued he was not comparatively negligent, the issue of comparative negligence was properly considered on plaintiff's summary judgment motion. Plaintiff ran into the door of defendant's car as the door was being opened. The court held that the plaintiff did not eliminate all triable issues of fact concerning his comparative negligence. The court wrote, although a plaintiff need not demonstrate the absence of his or her own comparative negligence to be entitled to partial summary judgment as to the defendant's liability, the issue of a plaintiff's comparative negligence may be decided where, as here, the plaintiff specifically argued the absence of comparative fault in support of his motion. Here, the plaintiff failed to establish prima facie that he was not comparatively at fault in the happening of the accident. A bicyclist is required to use reasonable care for his or her own safety, to keep a reasonably vigilant lookout for vehicles, and to avoid placing himself or herself in a dangerous position. In support of his motion, the plaintiff submitted the deposition testimony of the parties, which failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact as to whether the plaintiff exercised reasonable care while riding his bicycle. Although the plaintiff was not required to demonstrate his freedom from comparative fault to establish his entitlement to summary judgment on the issue of liability, the plaintiff failed to eliminate triable issues of fact as to whether the defendant was negligent, and if so, whether any such negligence caused or contributed to the accident. Next is the Joaquin case on page 6. It's a negligent supervision case involving a child who was injured in gym class, a kindergarten student. Third department held there were questions of fact whether the school was negligent in supervision of plaintiff kindergarten student in gym class. The infant plaintiff was instructed to jump, but her feet did not leave the ground and she fell forward on her arm. The infant plaintiff had an individualized accommodation plan, called a 504 plan, of which the gym teacher was aware. The court said, plaintiff's expert stated in an affidavit that the infant's physical limitations impaired her ability to function in class and engage in physical education activities. The expert opined that when taking into account the class size and the activities performed, defendant, that's the school, negligently supervised the infant by allowing her to jump without having a teacher in close proximity to her. Next is the Mabel case. On page 7, it's an elevator accident case, First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that summary judgment should not have been granted to the defendants in this elevator accident case. Plaintiff alleged the elevator door closed too fast and his thumb was caught in the closing door. Plaintiff alleged he had complained to the building superintendent, a building maintenance employee, and the management company about the door closing too fast. Both parties submitted affidavits from experts. The superintendent in training on the date of the accident testified he did not receive any complaints regarding problems with the elevator door. The field mechanic for the elevator service company testified that he did not complete any repair work with respect to the door opening and closing too quickly. He did, however, replace the elevator shoe, which is a necessary component for the elevator door to be able to close. Plaintiff testified that prior to his accident, he had complained to the then superintendent, another building maintenance employee, and the management company numerous times regarding the velocity with which the elevator door closed. Plaintiff testified that during one of his conversations with the management company regarding the elevator door, he was told that management would send a service company out to address the issue. Plaintiff testified that approximately 2 months before his accident, he witnessed a friend get hit in the shoulder by the fast-closing elevator door, and that plaintiff and his mother reported this incident to the then superintendent and the management company. The parties also presented conflicting expert affidavits regarding the potential causes of the alleged elevator door malfunction, including the purpose of the elevator shoe and the relevance of the velocity with which the door closed as it pertained to the cause of plaintiff's injury, which only further precludes a grant of summary judgment. Next is the Torres case on page 8. It's a slip and fall case that brings up an employment law issue. Second Department reversing Supreme Court held that defendant's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff, a cleaner employed by a non-party to clean the New York City school, tripped and fell as he was walking across the auditorium stage to turn on the lights. The defendant argued it could not be liable because plaintiff was injured by the very condition he was responsible to fix. The court wrote, "A plaintiff cannot recover against a defendant for common law negligence if he or she was injured by the dangerous condition which he or she had been hired to remedy. Here, the evidence submitted by the defendants established that the plaintiff was merely walking to the rear of the stage in order to turn on the lights in the auditorium. Thus, the plaintiff was not engaged in the type of cleaning activity aimed at eliminating the risk presented by the test board that had been left on the floor. In addition, the plaintiff's duty to clean visible debris off the floor had not yet arisen, because the plaintiff testified that due to the dim lighting condition in the auditorium, he had not observed the test board before his fall." Next is the Miske case on pages 8 and 9. It's another slip and fall case, this time raising an issue of landlord-tenant law. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the out-of-possession landlord's motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. The landlord did not submit a copy of the expired lease. The court wrote, "Generally, when a tenant remains in possession of the leased premises after the expiration of a lease, pursuant to common law, there's an implied continuation of the tenancy on the same terms and subject to the same covenants as those contained in the original instrument. By failing to submit a copy of the expired lease in support of their motion, the defendants failed to establish prima facie that they had no contractual obligation to remove snow and ice from the property." Next is the Rose case on page 9, another slip and fall, raising landlord-tenant issues. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the defendant out-of-possession landlord did not have a contractual duty to remove ice and snow and did not have actual or constructive notice of the icy condition on the rental property in this slip-and-fall case. The court said, "As a general rule, an out-of-possession landlord is not responsible for dangerous conditions existing upon leased premises after possession of the premises has been transferred to the tenant. Exceptions to this rule include situations where the landlord retains control of the premises, has specifically contracted to repair or maintain the property, has through a course of conduct assumed the responsibility to maintain or repair the property, or has affirmatively created a dangerous condition. When a landowner and one in actual possession have committed their rights and obligations with regard to the property to a writing, courts look not only to the terms of the agreement, but to the party's course of conduct to determine whether the landowner in fact surrendered control over the property such that the landowner's duty is extinguished as a matter of law. However, the fact that a landlord retains the right to visit the premises or even to approve alterations, additions, or improvements is insufficient to establish the requisite degree of control necessary for the imposition of liability with respect to an out-of-possession landlord. Without notice of a specific dangerous condition, an out-of-possession landlord cannot be faulted for failing to repair or otherwise rectify it. Accordingly, the ultimate burden is on the plaintiff to prove actual or constructive notice and a reasonable opportunity to repair or remedy the dangerous condition. Next is the Wesolowski case on page 10. The question raised here is whether the medical malpractice statute of limitations applied or whether the longer negligence statute of limitations applied to this hospital. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint on statute of limitations grounds should not have been granted. Plaintiff's decedent's injuries were alleged to relate to defendant hospital's improper restraint of plaintiff's decedent, apparently to keep him from getting up from the hospital bed. Defendant argued the 2.5-year statute of limitations for medical malpractice had passed. The Second Department held that defendant did not demonstrate that a doctor had ordered the restraints. Therefore, the defendant had not made out a prima facie case that the action sounded in medical malpractice as opposed to negligence. The court wrote, "The critical question in determining whether an action sounds in medical malpractice or simple negligence is the nature of the duty to the plaintiff which the defendant is alleged to have breached. When the duty arises from the physician-patient relationship or is substantially related to medical treatment, the breach gives rise to an action sounding in medical malpractice, not simple negligence. The distinction between ordinary negligence and malpractice turns on whether the acts or omissions complained of involve a matter of medical science or art requiring special skills not ordinarily possessed by laypersons, or whether the conduct complained of can instead be assessed on the basis of the common everyday experience of the trier of facts. Here, the defendant failed to establish that the plaintiff's claims were time-barred under the 2.5-year statute of limitations applicable to medical malpractice actions, that's CPLR 214-A. Since the defendant did not present any evidence that a doctor ordered the decedent to be restrained at any point to or during the subject incident, any point prior to or during the subject incident, the defendant failed to establish that the plaintiff's claims related to medical treatment as opposed to the failure of hospital staff to exercise ordinary and reasonable care to prevent harm to the decedent. Next is the Halberstam case on page 11. It deals with whether a municipality can be held liable for a problem allegedly created by the municipality's ambulance service. Second Department held the complaint against the Airport Emergency Medical Service, alleging liability for a delay in getting plaintiff to the hospital, was properly dismissed. Plaintiff suffered complications giving birth, which were alleged to have resulted in the baby suffering brain damage. The ambulance provided by defendant broke down, and plaintiff was transferred to another ambulance. The defendant was deemed to have been engaged in a governmental function, and there was no special relationship between the plaintiff and the municipal defendant. Therefore, the municipal defendant could not be held liable. The court wrote, Protecting health and safety is one of municipal government's most important duties, and emergency medical services have widely been considered one of government's critical duties. Defendant could not be held liable to the plaintiffs unless it owed them a special duty. One way to prove the existence of a special duty is by showing that the defendant assumed a special relationship with the plaintiff beyond the duty that is owed to the public generally. The plaintiff has a heavy burden of establishing the existence of a special relationship by proving all of the following elements. 1. An assumption by the municipality through promises or actions of an affirmative duty to act on behalf of the party who is injured. 2. Knowledge on the part of the municipality's agents that inaction could lead to harm. 3. Some form of direct contact between the municipality's agents and the injured party. And 4. The party's justifiable reliance on the municipality's affirmative undertaking. Of the four factors, the justifiable reliance element is particularly critical because it provides the essential causative link between the special duty assumed by the municipality and the alleged injury. Next is the Gretschko case on pages 12 and 13. It's a medical malpractice case. The plaintiff had died, and it raised several issues related to getting the statements of the decedent into the litigation. Second Department reversing the defense verdict in this medical malpractice case and ordering a new trial held that hearsay statements to the effect that plaintiff's decedent had signed an against medical advice, that's an AMA, against medical advice form, when he allegedly refused treatment at defendant hospital, were not admissible under the dead man statute or as statements against interest or admissions or as business records. The court said, a hearsay entry in a hospital record is admissible under the business records exception to the hearsay rule if the entry is germane to the diagnosis or treatment of the patient. That's CPLR 4518 subdivision A. Here, although the entries were germane to the decedent's diagnosis and treatment, the defendants failed to offer foundational testimony under CPLR 4518A or certification under CPLR 4518C. If an entry in the medical records is inconsistent with a position taken by a party at trial, it is admissible as an admission by that party, even if it is not germane to the diagnosis or treatment, as long as there is evidence connecting the party to the entry. Here, the entry clearly states that the decedent's primary care physician, not the decedent himself, was the source of the information. Pursuant to CPLR 5519, otherwise known as the Dead Man Statute, upon the trial of an action, a party or a person interested in the event shall not be examined as a witness in his or her own behalf or interest concerning a personal transaction or communication between the witness and the deceased person. Here, both witnesses were defendants at the time they gave deposition testimony, making them interested parties under the statute, and they both testified to transactions or communications with the decedent and sought to offer that testimony against the decedent's estate. The defendants argue that plaintiff waived the protections of the dead man's statute by eliciting the communications at issue. However, the executor does not waive rights under the statute by taking the opponent's deposition. Contrary to the defendant's contention, the declaration of the decedent did not fall within the declaration against interest exception to the hearsay rule because the defendants failed to establish that the subject statement was against the decedent's interest when made. Moreover, where the dead man's statute renders a witness's testimony inadmissible, the fact that the testimony would fall within an exception to the hearsay rule is simply irrelevant. Next is Matter of Perez on page 14. It's a slip and fall case that raises municipal law issues. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the petition for leave to file a late notice of claim in this sidewalk slip and fall case should not have been granted. The court said, although the photograph submitted in support of the petition may have demonstrated that the city had prior knowledge of the defect in the asphalt, actual knowledge of the defect is not tantamount to actual knowledge of the facts constituting the claim, since the city was not aware of the petitioner's accident, her injuries, and the facts underlying her theory of liability. A lack of due diligence in determining the identity of the owner of the property upon which the subject accident occurred is not a reasonable excuse for failure to serve a timely notice of claim. In addition, the petitioner failed to satisfy her initial burden of showing that the city would not be substantially prejudiced in maintaining a defense on the merits as a result of the delay. Next is the Brito case on page 15. It has to do with the physician-patient privilege. It's a reversal by the Court of Appeals and the facts are not discussed. Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held plaintiff had placed the condition of her knees into controversy in this accident case, and defendants were therefore entitled to discovery relating to the prior treatment of her knees. The court wrote, plaintiff affirmatively placed the condition of her knees into controversy through allegations that the underlying accident caused difficulties in walking and standing that affect her ambulatory capacity and resultant damages. Under the particular circumstances of this case, plaintiff therefore waived the physician-patient privilege with respect to the prior treatment of her knees, and the discovery sought by authorizations pertaining to the treatment of plaintiff's knees is material and necessary to defendant's defense of the action, citing CPLR 3101, Subdivision A. Accordingly, Supreme Court erred in denying defendant's motion to compel plaintiff to provide discovery related to the prior treatment of her knees. Next is the Salinas case on pages 15 and 16. It's a products liability case, and it raises an evidentiary issue. It's a Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division over two dissents, held summary judgment should not have been granted to the defendants in this personal injury case stemming from a potholder catching fire. The appellate division had reversed because plaintiff's deposition testimony conflicted with the conclusions of plaintiff's expert. Again, the facts were not discussed in this decision. The court wrote, the courts below erred in granting defendants motions for summary judgment on the basis that plaintiff failed to raise a triable issue of fact sufficient to defeat the motions. Although the plaintiff's deposition testimony partially contradicted the factual conclusions reached by her expert witnesses, the expert opinions were based upon other record evidence and were neither speculative nor conclusory. Insofar as plaintiff raised genuine issues of fact on the element of causation, summary judgment should not have been granted on that ground. Next is the DeJesus case on page 16. It's a slip and fall case that raises evidentiary issues that came up in an inquest after the defendant's answer had been struck. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that although defendant's answer in this slip and fall case had been struck, the defendant should not have been precluded from presenting evidence on damages. The court wrote, Supreme Court struck the answer and scheduled an inquest on the issue of damages. At the inquest, following direct testimony by the plaintiff, the court denied defense counsel's request to cross-examine the plaintiff since the defendant's answer had been stricken. The court awarded the plaintiff damages in the principal sum of about $270,000. A defendant whose answer is stricken as a result of a default admits all traversable allegations in the complaint, including the basic allegation of liability. but does not admit the plaintiff's conclusion as to damages. Accordingly, where a judgment against a defaulting defendant is sought by motion to the court, the defendant is entitled, at an inquest to determine damages, to cross-examine witnesses, give testimony, and offer proof in mitigation of damages. Here, since the Supreme Court did not provide such an opportunity to the defendant, we remit the matter to Supreme Court for a new inquest on the issue of damages. Next is Moiseyeva on page 17, another slip and fall case, this time raising the issue of what's required to demonstrate, or at least to provide prima facie case of the cause of the fall. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendants, that was New York City Housing Authorities, motion for summary judgment in this slip and fall case should not have been granted. Plaintiff's daughter, who witnessed the fall, provided sufficient evidence of the sidewalk defect. The court said, if a plaintiff is unable to identify the cause of a fall, any finding of negligence would be based upon speculation. That does not mean that a plaintiff must have personal knowledge of the cause of his or her fall. It only means that a plaintiff's inability to establish the cause of his or her fall, whether by personal knowledge or by other admissible proof, is fatal to a cause of action based on negligence. In support of its motion, the New York City Housing Authority submitted a transcript of the deposition testimony of plaintiff's daughter, who testified that she saw the plaintiff fall because of a crack or gap in the sidewalk, which made the sidewalk a different level. Next is the Gavinetio case, which is on page 19. It's another slip and fall case. It raises a couple of distinct issues. It raises the issue whether the contractor, a snow removal contractor, could be held liable to a third party who is not a party to the contract, and it raises issues related to the storm in progress rule. Fourth Department, modifying Supreme Court in the slip and fall case, held, one, the snow removal contractor, that's Fitzgerald's, motion for summary judgment was properly granted because no Espinal exception was pled, and two, there were questions of fact whether there was a storm in progress at the time of the fall, and whether there were slippery areas prior to the storm. The court said, a contractual obligation standing alone will generally not give rise to tort liability in favor of a third party. This is the snow removal contractor. And that cites Espinal versus Melville Snow Contractors, 98 New York 2nd, 136. Although there are three well-established exceptions to that rule, plaintiff did not allege facts in his complaint or bill of particulars that would establish the applicability of any of those exceptions, and thus Fitzgerald, that's the snow removal contractor, was not required to affirmatively negate the possible application of any of the Espinal exceptions. Instead, Fitzgerald had to demonstrate only that plaintiff was not a party to the snow removal contract and that she therefore owed no duty to him, which she accomplished by submitting a copy of the contract. Defendant submitted the deposition testimony of plaintiff, who testified that snow and rain had been predicted that day, but during the time leading up to his fall, it was merely overcast. Thus, defendant's own submissions raised an issue of fact whether there was a storm in progress at the time of the fall. Furthermore, defendant submitted the deposition testimony of an assistant store manager who testified that there were a few different slippery spots in the parking lot when she arrived for her shift, thus raising issues of fact whether the slippery condition preexisted the alleged storm and whether defendants had actual or constructive notice of the slippery condition. Next is the Thomas case on page 21. It's another slip and fall, and it illustrates that sometimes the defendant's assertion of a cleaning schedule or proof of a cleaning schedule can be sufficient to warrant summary judgment in a slip and fall case in favor of the defendant. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment should have been granted in this slip and fall case. Defendants presented evidence of the janitorial schedule for a particular day, which was deemed sufficient to preclude liability because plaintiff did not demonstrate the schedule was manifestly unreasonable. And plaintiff's testimony that defendants did not have actual or constructive notice of the alleged wet condition on the stairs. The court wrote, defendant superintendent offered testimony as to the janitorial schedule to be followed on a particular day. An established, reasonable cleaning routine precludes the imposition of liability. Whereas here the incident occurs outside of the scheduled cleaning routine, plaintiff's failure to raise a factual issue that such routine was manifestly unreasonable so as to require altering it warrants dismissal of the complaint. Furthermore, plaintiff testified that there was no wet condition on the stairs when he left the building, that upon his return a short while later he observed an alleged wet condition on the stairs, that he did not notify anyone of the condition, and that as a result of this condition he slipped and fell on the stairs as he was leaving the building a second time. Plaintiff's testimony demonstrates that defendants did not have actual notice of the purported wet condition or constructive notice, given that the condition did not exist for a sufficient length of time prior to the accident to permit defendants' employees to discover and remedy it. Next is the Allen case on pages 22 and 23, another slip and fall case, this time dealing with a property owner's duty to mop up tracked in snow and water. Second department held defendant property owner, a school, was properly found negligent in failing to mop up tracked in snow and water in this slip and fall case. Defendant's motion to set aside the verdict should not have been granted. Although a defendant is not required to provide a constant remedy to the problem of water being tracked into a building during inclement weather, and has no obligation to cover all of its floors with mats or to continuously mop up all moisture resulting from tracked-in precipitation, a defendant may be held liable for an injury proximately caused by a dangerous condition created by water, snow, or ice tracked into a building if it either created the hazardous condition or had actual or constructive notice of the condition and a reasonable time to undertake remedial action. Here, evidence was presented at trial demonstrating that the defendant had actual notice of the wet condition in the area where the plaintiff fell approximately an hour before the accident, yet failed to remedy it. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on the attorney affirmation. The verification code for this September 2019 negligence update CLE is TIRE. Again, the verification code for this September 2019 negligence update CLE is TIRE. Next is the Aybar case, that's AYBAR, on page 25. It's a jurisdiction case. It has to do with a lawsuit against Goodyear based on the allegation that a tire malfunctioned and caused an accident in Virginia. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that Goodyear's motion to dismiss the product's liability complaint for lack of jurisdiction should have been granted. Plaintiff, a New York resident, was injured when a tire manufactured by Goodyear allegedly malfunctioned, causing the car to overturn in Virginia. The Second Department held that plaintiff did not rebut Goodyear's argument that it did not have significant affiliations with New York, and noted that a corporation's registration with the New York State Department of State does not confer jurisdiction on New York. The court wrote, the plaintiff did not rebut the evidence submitted by Goodyear showing that Goodyear's affiliations with New York are not so continuous and systematic as to render it essentially at home here. Furthermore, contrary to the Supreme Court's determination, a corporate defendant's registration to do business in New York and designation of the Secretary of State to accept service of process in New York does not constitute consent by the corporation to submit to the general jurisdiction of New York for causes of action that are unrelated to the corporation's affiliations with New York. And finally is the Chung case, C-H-U-N-G, on page 26. It's another traffic accident case, and it deals with the adequacy of damages after trial. Second Department held the motion to set aside the damages verdict as inadequate in this traffic accident case should have been granted. Second Department ordered a new trial unless the defendant stipulates to an increased award of damages for past pain and suffering from $25,000 to $150,000 and for future pain and suffering from $0 to $100,000. The court wrote, while the amount of damages to be awarded for personal injuries is a question for the jury, and the jury's determination is entitled to great deference, it may be set aside if the award deviates materially from what would be reasonable compensation, citing CPLR 5501 subdivision C. Although prior damage awards in cases involving similar injuries are not binding upon the courts, they guide and enlighten them with respect to determining whether a verdict in a given case constitutes reasonable compensation. Under the circumstances of this case, where the plaintiff was required to undergo an anterior cervical discectomy and fusion surgery as a result of the accident, the jury's award for past pain and suffering was inadequate to the extent indicated. Further, since it was undisputed that the cervical fusion permanently reduced the plaintiff's cervical range of motion, the jury's failure to award any damages for future pain and suffering was not based upon a fair interpretation of the evidence and was inadequate to the extent indicated. So that completes this September 2019 negligence update CLE.